Patricia T. O'Connor is here now. She is the author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and now Woe Is I Junior for kids who are interested in the English language. You can also visit her blog at grammarphobia.com. And at that blog, she answers some of the questions that WNYC listeners have sent to her. She answers a lot more when she comes on our show every month, and it is my great pleasure to see you again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And, you know, before you even show up, people start sending in things. We have a whole bunch of email questions from our audience. Reminder that our number here is 212-433-9692. And I've been telling people that one of the things we are going to discuss is how words get into the dictionary.
Mm-hmm. That's something that people are always asking me. And as it happens, every year the Merriam-Webster people update the big 11th edition of their dictionary. They don't make a new edition. They just call it an update. And they add about 100 words. And this year, they just recently announced this year's new words, and the one that got all the attention was ginormous. I don't know if you've ever heard ginormous.
No, nobody's ever said that to
me. Yeah, I had never heard it either, but it's a combination of gigantic and enormous. And it turns out that it's actually been around since 1948. It was in the OED, 1948, in the Armed Forces Slang Dictionary, published by Eric Partridge. And it appeared in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on, but it just wasn't very well known. But there are a lot of other words among those 100 that are equally interesting, and I thought I'd run a couple by you and see if you can guess what they mean.
Okay.
Okay, here's one. You'll be using this one every day. Chaebol. C-H-A-E-B-O-L.
I have no idea.
It's a South Korean family-controlled industrial conglomerate. Now, how often is that going to come up in conversation?
The next time I say Daewoo, I guess.
And Sudoku, Samsung. Sudoku, of course, is in there.
Yeah.
That's no surprise. But how about Nocebo?
Nocebo?
Nocebo.
That's like
there's a clue in there.
There's a clue?
Yeah. Nocebo.
I know what a placebo
is. It's like placebo, exactly. It's like a placebo. It's harmless. But with a nocebo, the patient expects harmful effects.
And they don't happen.
Yes.
Now, why would you give somebody that?
I don't know. I'd like to know more about that word. I'd like to know how it got developed. I mean, are there studies where they're giving people harmless things and saying, now prepare for excruciating pain?
Ah, right. And you'll have stomach cramps.
Right,
it really will cure your arthritis.
Then there's telenovela.
Well, that we know.
Well, that's a Latino soap opera.
But they usually have ends, which our soap operas tend not to. They go on and on and on for hundreds of years. But telenovelas are like
they're
novels.
They're contained.
Yes.
Ah, I see. And how about viewshed?
Viewshed?
Viewshed.
Like V-I-E-W-S-H-E-D?
Right.
At the shed from which you view.
Actually, it's a portion of the environment that's visible from a particular viewing point.
A portion of the environment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So those, in other
those
words,
are
when
some
you,
of the new
when you
ones.
Drive through the national parks and they provide you with an area from which to take photographs.
Yeah.
That
they'll
is a
label
view shed.
It a view shed.
Ah.
View shed coming up. That sort of thing. But for those who are interested in knowing how these words get into the dictionary, Merriam-Webster actually has moles reading the newspapers, magazines, books, the internet for several hours a day. And they call this activity in their office reading and marking. And they collect words. And when they get a word gets a certain critical mass of exposure in enough kinds of media for a long enough time, they make a decision about whether to put it in the dictionary.
It's really more a quantity rather than quality thing. I could come up with the wittiest neologism and it wouldn't matter, right? But if a lot of people start using it,
then, right.
then
if it became a household name. But an interesting word to me, and I've always rather disliked being called this, is maven. I'm always referred to as a word maven.
Yeah, I avoid that.
I always thought it had a kind of a negative.
No, it doesn't. It's a very positive thing.
You think so?
Absolutely.
Well, I got an email from a listener, Marianne, who asked about maven, and she wondered if it meant someone self-appointed as an expert. Somebody self-taught, not formally educated. And I did some checking. And actually, it doesn't mean that. It means someone with expertise. It comes from the similar Yiddish word for expert, which comes from the Hebrew word for one who understands. And it doesn't really have those self-taught implications anymore. But interestingly, it first showed up in print in 1950 in English. And it was popularized in the mid-1960s by a Vita Herring advertising campaign. And the OED cites this 1965 ad that appeared in the Hadassah News. "Get Vita at your favorite supermarket, grocery, or delicatessen. Tell them the beloved maven sent you. It won't save you any money, but you'll get the best herring."
Somebody must have been pickled when he wrote that. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. Has anybody done a study of the words that have made it into the dictionary and then have fallen out of favor?
Probably someone has. I'll have to chase
that
down because
isn't
that
it?
Would be interesting to know.
Because there are words that
have
only
failed.
Momentary currency.
Sure.
Or then they change in many cases.
Uh-huh.
There's old slang that used to mean one thing, and then when I hear the phrase, the same words today from kids, I realize because of context that it means something totally different now.
Right. Well, I happen to be reading the Barsetshire novels by Trollope right now. I like to read them every 10 years or so. And I'm reading Framley Parsonage, and a guy in there who's very good at borrowing money from people and never paying it back is referred to as someone who's very cute, very sharp and very cute, with an apostrophe in front of cute.
From acute,
assume. From acute.
Being
so
sharp.
So that's one that that changed over the years.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We're talking about the language, but don't call her a maven. And our number here is 212-433-9692. This is WNYC. And WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and we can be heard on satellite. And before we go to the calls, let me read you one of the things that a person sent us on our comment line addressed to you. I heard a woman on a different public radio station, we're pleased to hear that, say, "When you look at the history and the herstory," and then This correspondent says, "I cringed, groaned, and then thought, wow, she must be pretty stupid. I would like to know what Ms. O'Connor thinks about such an unfortunate formation."
Well, I wouldn't call anyone stupid. I mean, I think there are
a lot of
people out there who think history has the masculine pronoun in it.
His story.
And that's not actually the case. History, as I will explain from the American Heritage Dictionary.
It has a long history, doesn't it?
It does. It's one of these beliefs that I think of as a sort of PC myth about English, that history must have the word his in it, and that herstory should therefore be the version that has women in it. But the derivation of history comes from the Latin historia, from the Greek historia, to inquire, from histor, a learned person. So it's more of an inquiry than it is anything masculine.
But you know, her story is in the Dictionary.
Is it in there, too?
I just looked it up in the American Heritage, and it says, the experiences and accomplishments of women, especially as seen in a historical context, the rest of the stuff of an unlikely herstory, Washington Post. The composite of experiences making up a woman's life, the truncated herstory of three black female students, Los Angeles Times. And that's it. They have no comment on it.
Mm. A blend of her and history under an interpretation of the latter as his story.
Well. Okay, should we go to some of the calls?
Yes.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. Patrick from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm not calling about a neologism, but foreign borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest using the Chinese particle ma for the location query.
The location query.
Yes.
I like that.
In other words, in Chinese, you can construct a question by a statement with the particle ma tacked on the end.
Well, that's the equivalent of the British approach, saying he was tall, wasn't he?
Yes, and I noticed, Leonard, if I may, that you sometimes have long, positive, factual statements.
Declarative statements, yes. Declarative sentences. You know why I do those?
With a question sort of notation tacked on at the end.
And do you know why I do that, Patrick?
I don't know.
I will reveal a secret here. If we've taken too long on the previous questions and there's a lot of material I still want to get in, I will throw some of it in myself as a declarative statement and then ask a question at the end of it. That might very well be an amalgamation of three planned questions that I could not get to.
Yes, so I have enjoyed the kind of location query, and I would just say that tacking the Chinese particle ma on the end of it might be an easier way of doing it.
Well, I'll start saying ma from now on, right? And nobody will understand what I'm saying but you, Patrick. Thank you for calling. But that is a problem sometimes. There are some guests who give very terse answers, and I run out of questions at the end, and I start asking them things like, uh-huh. Well, what did you have for breakfast? and then there are other people who give me wonderful, complete answers, and then I realize at the end, you know, there's three or four things that I really want to get to, and I can't get to them, so I say a couple of them, and then hope that when I put a question at the end of it, that the person I'm interviewing will cover everything.
This interviewing business is very complicated.
Isn't it?
There's a lot of thought that goes into it.
Joanne from Manhattan. No, where are you from, Joanne? Newark. Hi, Joanne.
No, I'm from Monroe Township, New Jersey.
Oh, I'm so sorry I moved you.
Thank you for taking my call. I live on a street spelled Glouceseter, and my husband pronounces it Gloucester. I pronounce it Gloucester, and I would like to know the correct pronunciation.
And I would pronounce it Gloucester.
I would, too. The reason is, if you write out the first part of it, Glouce, it's Glouce. Then you add ter, and it's ter.
So it's Gloucester.
Yeah. Now, if you wrote it Glouceseter, you could think of it as Gloucestershire or Gloucester.
Now, of course, this is a British thing, and there are a lot of those words
Worcestershire. That's one.
And they have done that. Cheltenham.
Right.
Cheltenham.
Cholmondeley.
Yes.
Pronounced throat warbler mangrove.
This is just one of those things that we've inherited from the British, Joanne, and we're going to have to learn to live with. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, and we go now to Alexis. Hi, Alexis. You're on the air.
Hi. My favorite word is maudlin.
Your favorite word is maudlin?
Maudlin.
Mm-hmm.
Magdalene, I believe.
Oh.
that maudlin.
Yes.
You're not talking about the one where people say, Leonard, that interview was maudlin.
Oh, yeah, right.
Ma?
Okay. My question is, and I feel like the village idiot, I'm always confused, no matter how many times I look it up, between the usage of affect and effect. Please help.
Well, the simple explanation is that affect is the verb and effect is the noun. Effect is a thing. And that's really all you need to know, because they can reverse places, but those places are so rare and unusual that don't bother.
So what is the effect of affecting the...
well, you might say that George Bush lacks affect. That would be using it as a noun, mm-hmm. affect. And that's the psychological sense. But 99 times out of 100, affect or affect is going to be a verb. And effect, the effect he has on people is electrifying. Mm-hmm. That would be a noun.
Affect is a noun when it, as you say, describes the way people speak, for example.
Right.
People who speak in a monotone have little affect.
True. Right. When it's a noun for, think of it as it's similar to affection.
But most of the time, it's affect means I am going to affect the your feelings about me by
making
you flowers.
A tremendous effect.
I'm really mucking this up. But I hope you understand it, and we're going to take a little break here. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we are talking about the English language. Stay with us.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
Another wonderful phrase is the velvet fog. And that was the phrase that was devised to describe Mel Torme, who we were just listening to. Velvet fog really is evocative. And mm-hmm. Do all languages have that ability? Or is English, because it just has so many words and has borrowed from so many different languages, have more than most?
I don't speak that many languages myself. English is the only one I'm really fluent in, and sometimes I have my doubts about that. But I would guess that all languages are evocative in their way, mm-hmm. because people have things that they want to evoke.
And they all wind up producing some form of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You receive a fair number of queries off
right.
the air, people writing to you at grammarphobia.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's mailbox@grammarphobia.com. And remember
right.
that grammar is spelled with three A's. Grammophobia is spelled with three A's and no E's.
Right.
And are there any ones that came in,
well, actually,
since you last were here?
In that little break when you mentioned Alicia Keys, that was evocative. It evoked a question that someone named Lars sent in, a listener to WNYC. And he was asking me about the use of the word key being increasingly used as a shortcut for something crucial and used as an adjective but without a noun. And what he's talking about is, for instance, if I say my education was key, I'm using key as a predicate adjective instead of my education was a key factor. Mm-hmm. Then I'm using it as an ordinary adjective. But he's annoyed by this, calling things key. And I did some checking on this, and key, as you might suspect, it's a very long word. It's been around as long as locks since about the year 1000, and it was originally pronounced K. But at any rate, in the 1990s, key acquired a new notoriety as a verb meaning to vandalize a car by scraping it. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Now that I live in the country, I have a car, and it has been keyed. But what the key we're talking about is the adjective. And in the 20th century, key started being used as an adjective in phrases like key fact, key industries, key office, key position. But not until the early 70s did it start appearing as a predicate adjective by itself. Two ideas were key. This is what's key. So I have to answer Lars by saying this isn't really a new usage, since it's been around since the 70s and people are still using it. It's probably here to stay. Although I agree, it sounds a bit abrupt. It sounds like there's something missing. That's probably just my ear, but I think that usage is probably with us, whether we like it or not.
Roger from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and you? I'm doing good. A listener said I should say I'm good.
Well, actually, that's part of my question. Actually, I'm from Butler, New Jersey. And about a few years ago, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, people stopped saying also and started using as well. And
you really think that happened 3 or 4 years ago?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's when I noticed it. But at first, you know, there was always a highbrow crowd that always used as well. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to become very commonplace, and now nobody says also. And
is that true?
It sounds like a little pretentious to me.
I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago your life changed in some way. You got a new job or you started going with a different crowd maybe. Because I think people with a little more elevated view of what they ought to sound like have always used as well instead of also.
But I think I use them interchangeably. Sometimes
I do too.
It's the as well gives me a different beat than the also does.
Right. And I think that I don't know about you, but I don't like using also at the end of a sentence. I've been there also. Mm. I've been there as well. Somehow it just seems better.
But I've also sounds, been there.
Yeah, also sounds better toward the front of the sentence, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that should be, but you wouldn't say as well I've been there. Mm-hmm. You'd say also I've been there, or I've also been there, not I've as well been there.
No. I think as well usually comes at the end of a sentence.
Right.
And it's a
right.
nice way to end a sentence. It puts a little bottom to it.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, Roger, that bothers you, but and maybe some of those people are being pretentious, but it seems to me that this is part of what makes the English language so wonderful, that we can say also, we can say as well, and use them equally. And Daniel from Stamford, Connecticut.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a Harry Potter question. I think
I thought the ending was lame. Is that the question?
She uses the word done, and I think it's superfluous many, many times. I've been telling my kids that it's wrong.
Oh, as in I have done?
Right, and it doesn't agree with the previous verb, like, I had jumped farther than she had done.
Uh-huh. That's a common British construction.
That's what I
And she
I
is would... a British author.
Uh-huh.
They do that often.
For
instance, I might say, have you read this book? And she might say, yes, I have done.
I have a British friend who does that, too, but...
Uh-huh.
I guess I should stop telling my kids that it's wrong and tell them it's okay.
Yeah, tell them it's a British usage. They're likely to find it in books by British authors.
Oh, okay.
It's not
thanks.
Incorrect.
Thanks for calling. Ellen from Manhattan. Hi. You're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
I have a comment about cute. The New York detectives about whom I have written often say cute, and they mean shrewd as well, but they have nothing to do with acute. They just say cute.
Right. I think that's not a revival of the old meaning of sharp. I think it's a mutation of the adorable cute.
Well,
like
maybe.
You're cute.
Yeah, I guess it is.
He was being rather cute about that.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's usually a comment. Like somebody did something kind of smart in a negative way, and they say, oh, cute.
Like a smarty pants way.
Yeah, but it has an evil edge to it.
Uh-huh.
And also, can I say something about as well?
Uh-huh.
I was reading a book about writing, and not a new book, an old book. And frequently, the author started sentences by saying, as well.
So there.
No. But that got your attention, didn't it?
Yes.
Probably because it was weird.
It was a stopper and not in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling us. Elaine from West Orange, you're on the air.
Hi there. What is driving me crazy lately is the proliferation of the I personally instead of just I.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a sort of plumper upper. It plumps up the sentence a little bit. It emphasizes the I a little more. It puffs it up. It's a filler.
Okay, but is it proper?
Well, I wouldn't say it's improper, but it's lame and redundant.
Exactly.
Usually, yeah.
I think to some degree that may even be in response to all those people who say, well, that's just your personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always a problem when I was a kid. I would say, oh, that movie stinks. And somebody would say, well, that's just your personal opinion. So I started saying, well, I personally think that movie stinks.
I mean, you know.
I wouldn't say anything that way anymore. Now everything is much more, what word do I want to, balanced or
reasoned.
I don't want to just simply say the movie stinks, even though there are some movies that really stink, as you know.
You'd say, in my opinion, the movie stinks.
Right. But
for what that's worth.
But my question, Conley, isn't the I, doesn't that just cover all of that?
Yeah, yes. The I is sufficient.
Exactly.
The personally really isn't needed. Unless there's some reason that the speaker feels he has to emphasize that.
Well, the personally is in the eye of the beholder. Thank you for your call. Anthony from Long Island, you are on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're quite welcome.
I was calling Pat. I was very interested in hearing you guys on the radio, and I was hoping you could help me deconstruct a sentence. I teach the SAT English section.
Uh-huh.
In my part-time, and in the book they were talking about I am well versus I am good, and sort of different ways to deconstruct that, one being I as a subject, am as the verb, and well being the adverb, and the other one being I as the subject, am as a linking verb, linking I to good.
Right. Every time I answer this question, I get furious mail from people. So here goes again.
I'm going to bring that up.
It's all right. It's inevitable. It has to happen every few weeks. But I am not bothered by a construction like I am good.
Yes.
It doesn't bother me.
Are you bothered when I say I am well, when people ask me how are you?
I am well doesn't
people correct
bother me
all
either.
The time.
But I think I am well has overtones of I am well health-wise.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm well in my health. I'm not sick.
And I am good sounds to me like you're telling people that you are a moral exemplar.
Well, you could be saying that if you wanted to strictly interpret good. But you could also be implying that not only in your morals, but your outlook, your current situation, your love life, whatever.
I'll stick to it.
You're doing very nicely. I think if we're going to allow linking verbs to be modified by adjectives instead of adverbs, then I am good qualifies.
Amy,
that's my opinion.
Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Whatever happened to I'm fine?
Glad to hear it, Amy.
Mm-hmm. I'm calling about the herstory question.
Which people did not get. They think a number of listeners have complained that you said that that history uses his and... you didn't say that. You said that it goes back to the Latin root, which has nothing to do with his or her.
Yeah, I said that the people who invented the term herstory did so under the misapprehension that the his in history was the masculine pronoun.
But it is not.
No.
Okay, and Amy, you wanted to add to this whole thing?
I don't think feminists were ever claiming that it was actually derived from his. But then there's the other hand. I noticed you looked that up in the American Heritage Dictionary.
Heritage, yeah. Yes.
Well, I think that we can all claim some part of the language, right? Heritage, very good, very good. Thank you so much. We're fast running out of time, and I do want to sneak a few more calls in. Tom from Brooklyn, hi,
Hello. You're
on the air.
Hi, Lennon. The word diminish, the verb diminish, mm-hmm. There's a noun that comes from that, and is it diminution, which is by the spelling, or is it diminution, which is also sort of by the spelling for minute? And then I think I've heard people say diminution.
Oh.
I even heard a candidate on the radio, the presidential debate, say diminution. it gets to be a tongue twister.
I think the noun is diminution.
Diminution. Oh, okay.
Yeah, praise like the Lord minute. And diminution.
Thank you. Oh, and herstory, you know, I have a pun on that. History, H-Y-S-T-O-R-Y.
Ah.
But it's kind of hard to hear it, you know. You have mm-hmm. to see it.
Yeah, that's one of those
that's
visual
hysterical.
Well, as long as we're in this mood, Lucille from Yonkers.
Oh, hi. A few words on succeeding versus successive.
Mm-hmm.
Is it successive days or each succeeding days or the next succeeding payment date? That's my question.
Well, days that succeed one another are successive.
Oh.
So succeed has two meanings, to succeed, meaning to win or achieve something, and succeed meaning to follow.
And so, they probably come from, do they come from the same roots, do you think?
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Because we have a number of words in English that are like that.
Yeah.
Where they are spelled exactly the same and have meanings that are totally unconnected, and yet perhaps in 1421.
Yeah, here's succeed. Somebody
succeeded because he succeeded.
Yeah, to come after. Yeah, from the Latin succedere, to go. Yeah, so to follow, to come after.
So
now, succeed, the other succeed, the success, comes from the Latin successus, past participle of succedere, to succeed.
And Julius
it looks
Caesar
like
did
they
very
are
well
the
with
same.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
We've run out of time.
Okay.
And I want to thank you all for calling and remind you that you can visit Pat O'Connor's blog at grammarphobia.com and you can write to her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. Meanwhile, you can also read all the books, and I'm not going to go through the full list, but the latest is Woe Is I Junior, just out. And Pat, it's always a pleasure having you here. Pat will be back with us on August 15th, and I look forward to seeing you then.
Me too. Bye.